Mr. Decobe.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Before this court is surely a new type of evidence in a case of first impression. But this court's obligation here is a very familiar one. Actually, you're balancing the rights. You're balancing rights of an accused and the right of the state to enforce the law and to investigate cases. And what you heard from my friends on the other side were basically six variations of the word never. That never can the state get this evidence under no circumstances, not no way, not no how. But the Fifth Amendment has never been used to obstruct lawful searches, and the Fifth Amendment protects against self-incrimination, not the disclosure of private information. And that is all the state is looking to achieve here, execution of a valid search warrant it obtained for defendants' phones. We don't want to know the passwords, we just want defendant to enter them, and we have no interest in using the fact that he opened the phone as evidence of anything. We're not looking for testimony or to have defendant speak his guilt, but merely to surrender access to something we were already entitled to. Now, with a warrant, or sometimes just a court order, a subpoena, without offending the Fifth Amendment, the state can inject a needle into someone and draw their blood to get blood alcohol content or DNA, force you to exhibit your handwriting, compel you to speak your voice, place you in a lineup, compel your signature for financial records, mandate you open your eye for a retinal scan, force you to put your finger on your phone to unlock it if it's encrypted with a fingerprint lock. But we can't compel a person to put their finger on their phone a few more times to unlock it to execute the valid warrant. As the Supreme Court said in Fisher, when an accused is required to submit a handwriting exemplar, he admits his ability to write and impliedly asserts that the exemplar is his writing. But in common experience, the first is a near truism and the later is self-evident. The question is not of testimony, but of surrender. Opening the phone impliedly admits an ability to do so, but him doing so gives us no more than that which we're already entitled to. And this court heard about a lot of cases, and there's a ton of cases cited in the brief, and a really good analogy, I think, is Doe 2. And it is an analogy, because we are talking about older cases, and we are doing our best to try to apply them to this new technology. The court's familiar with the facts of that case, but the court held to the extent there was some incriminating effect, it's not a testimonial communication. And the reason why this is a good example is because if Apple had access to the phone's contents and would only turn it over pursuant to a consent directive, then under the Fifth Amendment, we can get him to sign that directive and we would get the contents of the phone. Doing so would not be testimonial. Apple would be surrendering what they have based on defendant's release. The password is really like the authorization at issue here. And just to finish my opening, there's a few specific points I want to get to, but the real takeaway I want the court to get from me is that at the end of the day, what the state wants in this case is not never. The state would like a practical, workable solution to the problem at hand, something that gives us no more than that which is necessary to achieve the objective of the search warrant. The narrow order in this case that was affirmed by the appellate division, we think, achieves that purpose. I would welcome the court's questions, and of course I have a few things that I heard earlier that I'd like to respond to that I think are on some of your minds. The first one...
Can I ask one thing?
Oh, of course.
I assume you're done with your...
Yes, yes.
Does the state have an alternate way to access the contents of the phone?
As of Friday, no. Absolutely not.
We've heard the public defender has written about this, and it has been written about elsewhere. Are you telling us...
We cannot access that phone as of Friday of last week.
Have you attempted?
As far as I know, we have been attempting. So we have a very good opinion from the appellate division. If there was a possibility to keep that as the law of the land and to open the phone on our own, we would have did that. We wouldn't be here if we could open the phone.
If this court doesn't rule your way, are you going to try harder?
We can't try harder. We've tried. The record's clear that we've exhausted every avenue, both internally and reaching out to three preeminent organizations in this area. Including Cellebrite, which I believe is cited by the briefs. That's the Israeli company referred to in the in the transcript, and none of them could open these phones.
My question, you started out by saying we should be using a balancing test. And I'm not aware, at least from my review of our jurisprudence, when we're dealing with the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, that there is any balancing test. If a person is forced to incriminate himself, he or she has a right to invoke the Fifth Amendment. If the state has no way of finding the gun that was used in a shooting, there's no balancing test to determine whether or not the state can force the defendant to give the state the location of the gun. It either applies or it doesn't, and it goes to, as you've heard, the right of self-autonomy, dignity, privacy, all
that,
interests
right,
that undergird.
Is that something we don't already have? Like, we don't already know where the gun is, so we're not asking him to tell us where the gun is if we know where the gun is. In this case, we have the phone, we know what's on the phone, we have the right to access the phone, and all that's standing in the way is
you don't know
his entry of the
You don't know precisely what's on the phone. Are you able to rattle off to us the messages and the information precisely that you expect to extract?
Of course not. We wouldn't need the phone if we could do that. It's like any case with probable cause. We don't know exactly what there is, but we have a well-grounded suspicion that things are on that phone. And actually, the reason why I talked about the trial court's order and balancing, if you look at the language of the search warrant, we're entitled to everything on that phone. Absolutely everything contained in that phone.
That's the Fourth
Amendment. Right, and the court's order, correct, and the court's order narrows that because there's a Fifth Amendment concern here as well. So they say, okay, under the warrant, you get this. But under the Fifth Amendment and the state privilege, you only get this. What you were able to show with even more particularity than you did with the warrant. The warrant gets us everything on the phone. But we're not going to get that in this case. We didn't cross appeal on that. We're sticking with the court's order. The court's order strikes the correct.
You want the defendant to help you prosecute him by having the defendant retrieve some contents of his mind, the actual passcode. You can't. You need his assistance to prosecute him, and that's one of the things that the Fifth Amendment protects: self-incrimination. And there are other provisions of the Constitution that also bar that, because you have the burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prove it, to prove the charge, and that's without the assistance of the defendant.
Right, and we welcome that burden, but the defendant at the same time cannot obstruct that investigation. Same thing with the list of things I rattled off. Those are all examples of the defendant helping us prove our case. In a DUI case, his blood helps us. It actually proves an element of the offense, but he still has to do it.
But there's a difference there. And take the blood example that you're giving us. There's no thought process that the defendant goes into as compared to divulging the passcode. No?
Maybe not in that example, but certainly in the handwriting example and a few of the other examples, there is a thought process involved. And again, that thought process is not, we're not going to be privy to that. We're not going to know the password. We're not going to use the fact that he opened it.
Even with handwriting, are you conveying the contents of the mind by writing words out that you're being asked to write, as opposed to providing the particularized password that you have, which then provides a link to incriminating evidence?
Well, I think the answer is right in Fisher. I think that the handwriting exemplar admits an ability to write and asserts that the exemplar is his writing. That's what it's for. That's the purpose of the exemplar. But it doesn't make it testimonial and violative of the Fifth Amendment.
So our evidential privilege and common law privilege says, let's quote a little piece of it so you can comment on it, because it's by its very language it seems to be broader than the Fifth Amendment. Every natural person has a right to refuse to disclose in an action or to a police officer that any matter that will incriminate him. And then it goes on to explain the different statute, what matter means. And matter under 84A-18C is a clue to the discovery of a matter which is, and it says within two other clauses, and that discovery is any information that will assist in proving an element of the offense. Not like, why doesn't that information fall squarely within that language?
Well, first of all,
disclosing a matter, the matter being the passcode, that is a clue to the discovery of information that will incriminate the defendant.
It's not a clue to the discovery, first of all, because we know it's on. If we had no idea it was on the phone, you might be right. But under, I'd like to keep reading what you read before. And it, yes, it says any matter. It says, but it says except under this rule. And then B talks about when there's a right to superior possession. The state has the right to a superior possession in the contents of the phone to search.
So the right, so this is the way I understand the right to superior possession, because I think you have a novel approach. The right to superior possession typically applies when a person is working for a corporation. Okay, someone's an agent of a corporation and is attempting to withhold information, or an officer of the government who has access to records. In those cases, the corporation, the government, has superior right to the information. I don't see how that applies here when it happens to be the defendant's cell phone, his information, not another person's information, information that he has constructed on his own for his own purposes. So I don't understand how that.
So a couple responses. It is novel, certainly. There's not a lot of cases talking about this. And again, there's new technology at work here. So I can't tell you state versus such and such supports my position. So I'll admit that. I don't think it can be read that broadly given the technology and what we're talking about. When police officers enter a house, they have a right to enter the house, they have a right to search the house. We had a right to seize the phones. There's no way a defendant can get those phones back from us until we give them back to him. We don't have a legal right to possession. That's pointed out in one of the briefs. We can't sell the phone and keep the money. But we have a right to possess the phone. So I think that's what that exception can be applied to.
But this is about self-incrimination we're discussing here. Your example relates to the police entering with a warrant. That's not what we're
doing. It's different. I mean, what I said about the cell phone is more on point, I think. We have a right to possess the phone. And my point about the search warrant was we have a right to enter the house and to be present in the house for that. That was my point. But
it's hard to get that from the language of 19B, which speaks about persons, corporations, or other associations and not governments.
I mean, practically speaking, it's not there, but I think it has to be read into those words, or other association. Anyone, person, corporation, et cetera, with a superior right to the possession.
Are you asking us to reverse our decision in Guarino?
No, absolutely not.
I'm just going to read to you a line or two, and then you just comment on it.
Of course.
So in Guarino, we said, we affirm our belief in the Boyd Doctrine and hold that the New Jersey common law privilege against self-incrimination protects the individual's right to a private enclave where he may lead a private life. To determine whether the evidence sought by the government lies within that sphere of personal privacy, the court must look to the nature of the evidence of documents, and therefore a court must look to the contents, not to the testimonial compulsion involved in the act of producing them.
Okay,
what do you think that means?
So a couple of responses. A private enclave to a private life. There's probably no more private enclave than the home. I think we would all probably agree with that. In appropriate situations, the government can intrude upon
that
private
enclave. That's
the
Fourth Amendment. So we're dealing with the Fifth Amendment. That's what the chief was.
But the language in Guarino talks about the nature of the evidence. So let's look at that evidence we're talking about. We're talking about conversations. Not everything on the phone, of course, because the trial court's order is limited. Conversations between co-conspirators. One of those co-conspirators is a law enforcement officer, and the state has obtained a valid search warrant. So the Guarino was a subpoena case, not a search warrant case.
Guarino dealt with the requirement to turn over corporate records, and it was distinguishing between, I think, unless you can tell me otherwise, corporate records from personal records. Am I mistaken?
Right,
about
no,
that?
And corporate records were at issue there, and the court was not opining about any other type of records. And again, certainly Guarino is not controlling in this case because it's not addressing the same issue. And
your position is that the private enclave concerns that are identified in Guarino are dealt with by the court order.
Absolutely.
And the limitation to these direct communications.
Absolutely.
Can I bring you back to something that you started out with, and I keep trying to wrap my head around it? The gun. You can't force the suspect to take you to the gun. But if you know the gun's at his house, in a safe, you can get a search warrant for that safe, correct?
Correct.
The safe has a combination lock. How do you get to it?
I mean, presumably, if we can open the safe,
you would drill
with brute force.
You would drill.
We would.
Not that I've ever done that. you drill just
me
like
either.
You would pick a lock.
Right.
Have you done that?
You don't have to.
I have the right to remain
that's
silent.
That's why he's not allowed in my house.
You have
see,
a right
that would be a Fifth Amendment
right
violation, right
that's
there.
That's not what. That's why
great
he's not
example.
Allowed in my house.
Okay, so what you're asking now is to be able to do that. Can you compel him to give you the combination of the lock for the safe?
No, but I think we could compel him to open it for us.
Okay, likewise for the key to the safe if it's key based.
Right, and there would be zero testimonial relevance to that. So either have him open the safe or give us the key.
And what about open the door to the house?
If the door could not be opened under any other way, then I think he would have to open it. Whether it's a house, a safe, a cell phone, the analysis
so
is
it's
the
access,
same.
So it's how you get access to the private domain. In this case, how you get access to the phone. In that case, how you get access to the safe. In another case,
not
how
just
you get
that
access.
Though. It's what he's giving. What he's giving us. In that act.
But
so
let's say he's hidden
he's
the key.
He's giving us access. He's giving us surrender.
Let's say it's a physical key to that safe, since we're talking about old-fashioned stuff like safes. And he's hidden it somewhere. You can't make him tell you where he hid it, can you? The key. You got the safe.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that. I think we can. I think and under this analysis, if we know what's in there, and we know he knows where the key
how
is.
How are you going to force him? He refuses to show you where the key is. You're going to get a court order, have him held in contempt for not locating the key for you?
If you can prove to the trial court that he knows it and he's willfully disobeying a court order, then yes. That's absolutely what would happen.
But the issue is, does that court order violate the Fifth Amendment?
Well, no, it doesn't if the court... If the court has a hearing and believes, and it is very possible in this case, given the time that has passed, if Mr. Andrews says, I do not know the cell phone and the password, and the judge believes him, then that's not contempt.
No, but a court say, okay, you're saying that the key is needed to the safe, even with brute force, you haven't been able to break into it. Can the court order that defendant to tell the state where to find the key?
Yes, because he'd be surrendering access to that which we're entitled to, which is the safe. Again, the analogies aren't...
Why not get an order forcing him to disclose where he hid the gun in the house? Can you do that?
No, because we wouldn't know where the gun is. Or we would just go in and get it. If we knew it was in a safe, and we knew he knew the password or the where the key was to the safe, then that's a different situation because he's not giving us anything we don't already know about. I mean, he's surrendering access to these things. That's always, that's always going to be what happens. But
you see the problem with where this is on the spectrum of previous decisions.
I do, and that's why our position is not, we just get it as a matter of course anytime we ask for it. We're asking for a workable solution, something that we can work with going forward. And if we can't meet the requirements of the foregone conclusion doctrine as enunciated by this court, then we won't get it. And what has happened, practically speaking, I can tell you, is we get requests from police officers for a court order like in this case. And we will ask the police officer, well, tell us about the case. If we don't think we would be able to prove the elements of foregone conclusion to a court, we don't even bring that to the court. We're not running wild with State versus Andrews in the appellate division opening cell phones left and right. I don't know that we've opened any since Andrews pursuant to a similar court order. So the order in this case is extraordinary, and I think it correctly balances the rights. And you know, to the extent this court is worried that, you know, we're going to take this and now somehow trample over everyone's Fifth Amendment rights and get into their phones, the reality is that's just not happening.
If there is noncompliance, let's assume that this court would rule in your favor. Okay, you get that order of compulsion, and there is noncompliance. Is it your position that you can incarcerate the defendant indefinitely until he purges himself of the contempt?
Maybe, and that's what the point is. The court would hold a hearing on contempt, well, and then it would determine whether he really doesn't know or whether he's just being obstructive.
Assume like in the Pennsylvania case where the person said, "I am not revealing my passcode. I don't care if you send me to jail." Under those circumstances, is it your position that you can hold the person in prison indefinitely until he purges himself of the contempt?
Yes, because in that case he says, I know the password, I'm just not giving it to you despite the court order telling me to. That's no different than any other court order. If someone willfully disobeys it and a court sitting as a finder of fact finds that they're willfully disobeying the court order, they're going to be held in contempt.
Do you have any issue
That's not a novel point.
Sorry. Do you have any issue with providing in connection with this request the exact information you're looking to get off of the phone? In other words, here you have a number of phone calls from a particular phone number and a range of times or specific times when they were given based upon the information from the sending phone number. Do you have any problem with making as part of what you are required to do, providing exactly what it is you want to get off that cell phone?
I guess it depends how exact you're talking.
Well, you tell me how exact.
Okay.
You have no objection.
If it's so exact that it can only be answered by the contents of the phone itself, then that can't be the standard. We'd never get it. Because if we already knew that to a T, we wouldn't need the phone.
Right.
But it has to be, and I think reasonable particularity is sufficient. Other states have raised the burden as a matter of state law. And that's always something this court could do if it thought appropriate. Massachusetts talks
what
about beyond.
What should that standard be?
I think reasonable particularity is sufficient. Other courts have said beyond a reasonable doubt is required. But again, it can't be so exact that we have to prove to the trial court, you know, there's 42 conversations. They occur at all of these times. They're this long in duration. There's 8 text messages. They say this precisely. If we had all that information, we wouldn't need the phone, right? So we're still, this is an investigative issue. So it can't be that exact.
Why should we even be noting the doctrine of foregone conclusion when we have explicitly rejected following Fisher and Doe in Guarino?
This court has never addressed whether we should adopt foregone conclusion or not. Guarino doesn't reject that doctrine. It mentions it when it's talking about those cases, but it certainly doesn't apply it.
Well, we said we decline. Neither Fisher nor Doe recognize the fundamental privacy principles underlying the New Jersey common law privilege against self-incrimination. In defining the scope of our common law, we declined to follow the court's rationale in Doe. It looks like we just rejected that.
Well, that was Doe 1. Doe 2 implies it.
And we also quoted quite generously from Justice Brennan's dissent, I think, in Fisher, his concurrence in Fisher, rejecting the methodology of the majority.
Again, but I think one of the things we all agree on is that, you know, I don't think this court has said one way or the other whether foregone conclusion should be adopted in this state, and we think it should because it strikes that correct balance. It doesn't force the accused to turn over more than necessary, and it doesn't forever stymie law enforcement efforts. One of the questions, Justice Albin, you asked about Hubble and whether Hubble narrowed the foregone conclusion. I don't think it did at all. What it did was it applied the foregone conclusion, and it said under the facts of that case, the government loses, because the government really had no idea what was in those documents. They really wanted the defendant in that case to do all the work for them and to turn over the documents that, you know, he thought would incriminate him, which is obviously very different. Here we think we can show with sufficient particularity what's on the phone, what we're looking for. We're not requiring him to tell us more information that we don't have. That's what was happening in Hubble. They basically wanted Hubble to give them all this information, and they really didn't know what it was. It was really a fishing expedition. So I think Hubble supports my broader position that we need a workable test, and in some cases, with any workable test, the state will lose. The state will lose a lot. Sometimes the state will win. But you know, we think there needs to be an opportunity to make a proper showing to get this evidence to which we are entitled to.
Can you address a little bit more this question about alternative methods? There's been representation in one of the amicus briefs that there are alternative methods that you could use.
Well, a couple things. Okay, so as a matter of fact, in this case, there are no alternative methods. One of the things this court could require, and you know, as a matter of state law, and the state would be fine with that, and it's certainly met in this case, is something of an exhaustion requirement to avoid the opportunity for the state to just demand passwords left and right without, you know, quote unquote, doing any of its own work. But if the state can show that it took these, you know, lines of attack, tried to get into the phone otherwise, and just couldn't do it, then that's ultimately up to the trial court to say whether those efforts.
This is a 2015, these are two 2015 iPhones. Am I right about that?
Yeah, one's an iPhone 5, one is a 6,
okay.
I believe.
And what is it, I'm just curious as to what you've been told about why those can't be accessed by these independent companies.
They were never resubmitted to those companies since 2000, I guess, 15 and 16, because you know this litigation has been going on. But as of Friday, our own independent ability has not caught up with that technology.
Okay. So do you know as you're here, whether the access technology that has presumably developed since 2015 and 16 has caught up with this phone? In other words, if those independent companies now are able to access this
particular
model.
I cannot make that representation. But,
do you understand what I mean? Because it seems to me, just a little bit I've read in the press about
it. I mean, I guess, you know, it is possible, that's for sure, but not necessarily. And again, that's one of the things I talked about with an exhaustion requirement.
Is there any jurisdiction anywhere in the country that recognizes, in regard to the Fifth Amendment, an exhaustion requirement that if the state cannot locate something that it needs to prosecute a defendant in a case?
Not in those terms.
Like armed robbery. State has exhausted its efforts to find the gun, hasn't done it. Okay.
The cases do talk about the efforts of the government in those cases to achieve, you know, execution of the warrant without that. So they don't hold it as a matter of law, but again, we're walking on new territory here.
Anything else you'd like to add?
I think I said everything I want to say. One thing I did want real quick. Chief, you asked about the concern, aren't we sending a message to criminals that this is a safe haven? Of course you are. The next question was, well, does it matter? It absolutely matters, because if you look at the Hunt factors that are discussed in detail in the Attorney General's brief, which is the guidance for this court when you diverge, there are public policy considerations to take into account when doing that analysis. And Justice Handler says, you know, you don't depart from the federal constitution just to reach a different result. There are considerations to follow that will guide your discretion. So I think a public policy concern, like you referenced, is a relevant consideration when determining whether to diverge and whether and how far to diverge.
But not to the analysis of the Fifth Amendment.
I mean, I don't know that that's ever been a basis.
We've never
Haven't
adopted.
We already diverged?
Yeah.
To some extent, but not on this issue, of course. And, you know, our position, first and foremost, is that the federal law in this area, to the extent it exists, does adequately protect. But if this, I could see why this court, you know, may disagree and may follow that language. But to answer the chief's question, it's absolutely a relevant consideration. It's not irrelevant by any stretch.
We've never adopted the divergent criteria, and the author of it, Justice Handler, who wrote in Guarino, specifically stated that our jurisprudence on the common law right against self-incrimination diverges anyway from the Fifth Amendment.
But it doesn't diverge in every single case. And a lot of the cases cited, I know particularly in the county prosecutor's brief, the examples I read earlier about handwriting exemplars and other Fifth Amendment issues, the court has not diverged in those. So it's not as simple to say, well, this is Fifth Amendment case, we throw the Fifth Amendment away, we go our own way. The court has never done that. The court has always undertaken a thoughtful analysis before it diverged on any issue, including Fifth Amendment ones.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Leonard.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to quickly first address the court's concerns about the possibility of getting into the phone in the first place using methods other than the passcode from the defendant. And the answer is it can take, in some cases, it can take hours, but in most cases, it can take actually decades to get into, to crack a passcode. Because the way these things work is, say, with a four-character numerical passcode, it'll start with 0000 and then continue on from there until it hits the right number. But more and more phones have better and better passcodes. And Android devices now can be passcode protected with phrases using letters and numbers. And we know of computer crime cases where encryption software uses 64-character passcodes, and that's letters, numbers, and special characters. And so it's not hyperbole to say that if we use these algorithms and try through brute force, it will take decades or potentially even the defendant's entire lifetime to get to the correct passcode. And so that doesn't quite address the Fifth Amendment concerns there, but that's the answer to that question, is that it, and it is a relevant concern, that these child pornography cases, for example, cannot be now prosecution proof because they've got a really good passcode. So moving to the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment is implicated if it's testimonial, compelled, and incriminating. Here, it's not testimonial because we're not asking the defendant to reveal his passcode. And the analogy of the wall safe versus the surrendering the key, the court, even though that is just dicta, the court said he wouldn't be able to reveal the passcode to a wall safe, or the combination rather. And what we're allowing the defendant to do here is enter the passcode himself. And that is a difference. He doesn't have to say it out loud. And to the extent that it is testimony at all, we've also offered use immunity to the defendant. And Fisher makes clear that disclosure of private information may be compelled if immunity removes the risk of incrimination. So we'll never say to a jury, we know this is his phone because he gave us the passcode to it. And even if his passcode is, I gave information about wiretaps to gang members, we'll never know that. So the Fifth Amendment is not offended by compelling the passcode from the defendant himself.
How would this work as a practical matter? He punches in the passcode to his phone, hands it to the court, and what happens when the phone quickly shuts down and shuts out everybody who doesn't have that passcode?
From my understanding, the state can then remove the passcode so that it doesn't lock again. And they can also clone the phone at that point, or a computer. So they wouldn't have to over and over again get the passcode. They would be able to get it the one time and never hear it from the defendant, never see it, have it written down. and continue to search.
Well, remove the passcode's one thing, but cloning the phone gets access to anything and everything that may or may not be related to the search warrant.
Well,
that's a problem.
Not necessarily, because it's no different from just having the phone and searching it, or going into a house and searching it. And if we're looking for something large in a search warrant, we're inside the whole house, but that doesn't mean we necessarily go searching and everything. And that brings up the issue of, you know, how we have everything in our lives are now on our phones, and everything's in this one place, and the Riley v. California concerns. It's no different from when we would search a house and go in somebody's underwear drawer and bedside table drawer and desk drawer and see the diary there. And if we're looking for records of financial transactions and drug deals, for example, we're going to look through that diary and see if it's there. So there is a lot of private information on our phones, but there's always been private information in our lives. And that's why the search warrant protects those interests.
So you would not envision the court, obviously with technical assistance, doing the initial review of this phone or controlling, overseeing the state's access to the phone?
I think that there have been some cases where the court orders are having the defendant disclose or enter the passcode in camera. But I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. I think that, especially for, you know, maybe if the search of a desktop computer, that wouldn't necessarily work, because if we unplug the computer, that might cause problems with getting back into it. So I don't think that necessarily has to be the way that this is accomplished.
I'm suggesting that the trial court's oversight is an important protection here. So you would, despite the in-camera language that the trial court used, you would envision that there would be just a quick process of getting into the phone, and then the state gets access to the entire phone?
I think that if the trial court wants it to be in camera, then that can be included in the order, but I don't think that has to be a bright line or across the board rule, because the court doesn't oversee any execution of a search warrant to that degree. So just because we have access to the whole phone doesn't mean that we're going to go searching through bank records, for example. We're not going to look in your bank apps if what we're looking for is images of child pornography or conversations with minors. We would look in text messages and then direct messaging applications and Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, those sort of, you know, it depends on what the search warrant entails.
How should this line play out in our discussion of this issue? I'm going to read to you one line from Guarino, which is quoting Justice Brennan when he was Justice Brennan on the New Jersey Supreme Court, who said, "The wide acceptance and broad interpretation of the privilege rests on the view that compelling a person to convict himself of a crime cannot abide the pure atmosphere of political liberty and personal freedom." So I know that's a rather broad concept, but how does that play out in our evaluation of this issue, where the state is attempting to compel the defendant to give the password that is only known to him in order to convict him?
It's just like a handwriting exemplar. It's even then, the defendant or the suspect would be copying something that somebody else has written, and he's using his mind to make that happen. Here, the defendant has to recall his passcode, but he's not revealing it, and it doesn't offend the Constitution
anymore.
What's
in his mind is only known to him. If it wasn't only known to him, you wouldn't have a problem in terms of his passcode. Asking someone to write down a word, dog chasing cat, okay, is not revealing something that is uniquely known to the defendant and only known to the defendant. That is what you're seeking.
But neither is entering the passcode, because he's not revealing it. And anyway, most of these passcodes are, they're either random numbers or they're, you know, maybe your kid's birthday. There's nothing particularly private or, just because he has to recall it, it's not intellectual property. It's just the passcode. But it's a barrier that the defendant has put between the evidence that the state has the authority to seize and...
He has that passcode. Most people have their passcode because they want to keep the entire world out of their phone. That is that little sphere of privacy that we've all created for ourselves, not just the government, it's anyone else who may pick up our phone. We don't want people reading our phone, including the government. Am I correct about that?
Yes, but that's why we have a search warrant, because we don't want people entering our homes either. But under certain circumstances, when crimes have been committed, we make a certain showing, and we have the authority to search a certain area. And there are houses now, actually, where you can punch in a code rather than
you
use an actual
key. You can search the phone. You got the, you have the. The question is whether or not you can compel what's in the defendant's mind.
Correct, and that answers whether or not we can actually search the phone.
This case would affect child pornography prosecutions. Can you address that, please? In terms
sure.
of encryption that's going on in that. Those types of cases?
Sure, because this case will also apply to the trial courts. We use this as precedent on all computer crimes cases. And in the child pornography realm, we know that these defendants have very securely encrypted their computers with the, as I mentioned before, the 64-character passcodes. And our state lab detectives tell me that it will take many decades for the algorithm to actually get through to those. And in crimes where the entire crime, all evidence of the crime is on the computer, then the defendant would be making himself completely prosecution proof. And to address the Chief Justice's concerns about the safe haven, that would absolutely create a safe haven for child pornographers, because all they have to do is passcode protect their computers.
That's true of virtually all organized criminal activity today, is it not?
I don't know how exclusively it is, but this does apply. We've seen it come up in gangs cases, and as well as child pornography, as well as official misconduct. It's coming up
in
every realm.
Likewise, when you referred to the handwriting exemplar. It is a handwriting, but by doing so, the suspect is identifying his handwriting style to be linked to some criminal conduct or activity, and that's you're associating that with what's happening here, correct?
Right, correct. And also that brings up too the difference between, that I wanted to mention, this area of case law as opposed to the compelled production of documents such as Fisher and Hubble and the Does and Guarino, there the state had subpoenaed specific documents and told the defendant, go retrieve these specific incriminating documents, which is very different from saying, just enter the passcode and we'll conduct the search. Those cases didn't involve search warrants. And in many of the cases where the government lost, no immunity had been offered. And so those are important distinctions between those cases and what we're asking for here.
Any other questions? Anything else, Ms. Lynn?
Just very quickly, just to say that in the cases of the example of go find me the handgun, that's just a Fifth Amendment question, and it's not really applicable in the realm of we have a search warrant and we're just asking for access to have the ability to actually execute that warrant.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. Let me leave off on something that we were just talking about, which was making defendants immune from prosecution. We talked about in the context of child pornography. The Appellate Division did recognize that to prevent the state from obtaining the passcode in this case, it would have the effect of preventing the state from obtaining the passcode in virtually any case where there's a passcode protected device. And on page 21 of the decision, the Appellate Division recognized and held that the Fifth Amendment should not be interpreted to make the execution of a search warrant under the Fourth Amendment impossible. Going back to 2014, the United States Supreme Court held the same thing. In Riley versus California, the court recognized that in this age, often the most important, the most accurate, the most relevant information we might have in a criminal investigation is contained on phones and computers. I don't think there's any precedent, at least not one that I could find, from any state or federal court that found any particular thing or object immune from a search under the Fourth Amendment. So the state does have an interest, a strong interest, an investigatory need in this case. We are asking that the court consider that, along with the defendant's interest. And in coming up, in listening to the court and trying to come up with a test, maybe a rule going forward that trial courts can apply, what I was struck by more than anything else in this case was the incredible care and consideration that the trial court gave to this particular issue, how sensitive it was to this issue. If we look at how narrowly tailored and limited this court order is, it limits the state. We can only look at two things, the phone call icon and the text message icon, nothing else. Not only that, only the phone call icon and the text message icon as it relates to conversations between Lowry and the defendant. Not only that, but to make sure that the state does not go on some sort of fishing expedition, they don't go beyond that. The search is to be done in camera, in the presence of defense counsel, and in the presence of the court. Second, and that's the first of four factors that I think are critically important in this particular case. Second is the granting of use immunity over the code itself. There was discussion in the record, what if the code itself has some sort of evidentiary value? Let's say it was Bolo, this defendant's alleged street name. Well, as I understand the record, and I would certainly agree as a representative of the state that it should, use immunity should be granted in this case. The state should not be able to use this passcode in any way, shape, or form against the defendant. As recently as 2 weeks ago, this court held, in the context of a compelled communication, in that case, a civil forfeiture answer, which could be compelled under the Fifth Amendment, that the cure, even when criminal charges were pending against that particular defendant in State versus Melendez, the cure was to grant use immunity. We're asking the court to apply the same standard here.
But you don't want derivative use immunity.
Not derivative
either.
Use. We would just ask for use immunity
is,
over the code.
Which is typically what we do. If something is compelled, then all the fruits of what was compelled is also immunized. You don't want that, do you?
We don't. Although I'd be hard-pressed, I think, candidly, not to concede that if we didn't have an underlying search warrant. That's what protects the actual content of the information in this case.
And the court order that imposes limits that are well within the parameters of the search warrant.
Very, very limited. So, I mean, there really is no chance in this case of the state, and I understand what counsel's saying, and there's some truth to it. I mean, our phones, our computers, they're very personal. They're intimate. We don't necessarily want the state just rummaging through every aspect of our personal lives, and that's not an issue here because of the limited nature of the court's order. As Mr. Ducote mentioned, there was also exhaustion. Exhausting every other possible remedy in this case, and I think that's important. And if we think at the lengths to which the state went to here, not only did they exhaust all of their internal resources, they went out to the Jersey City Police Department, a department known for having the state-of-the-art equipment in this area. They couldn't get in. They went to the NYPD. They couldn't get in. They went to the FBI. And the outside agencies, the Israeli company, Cellbrite, I believe it is. So they tried everything. Based on the record here, that phone simply, they couldn't get into it. And I think exhaustion should be a requirement because I don't know that the default should be, let's file a motion to compel a defendant to provide. There should be an exhaustion requirement, I think. And
I'm not sure exhaustion is the right way to go, but would it apply if, as I understood the earlier presentation, the state hadn't gone back to these private companies for 4 years, which is a lifetime when it comes to technology?
It is a lifetime. It's something that Mr. Ducote and I spoke about last week, whether, and I know he did go back to check to see if there was any ability to get back in those phones at this juncture, but we are stuck with just the record that we have, which unfortunately dates all the way back to, I think it's December of 2015 in the motion hearings.
Is there any other setting where Fifth Amendment privilege has been addressed through a balancing of interests like you're suggesting? Because I'm having a hard time conceptualizing this exhaustion argument that we're having. I can certainly understand the arguments the state and you are advancing regarding whether it should apply or not, but if it applies, I just don't see how we get into a balancing.
Well, I think, and again, it's a new age with new issues, complicated issues under technology, but going back to 2014, I look at language from Riley, for example, that says the Constitution should not be interpreted to make cell phones and computers immune from search. And I think given
so you think the Fifth Amendment is one of those provisions of the Constitution that's capable of evolving into lesser or greater protection over time?
Yes, it does evolve with facts, I think. So how does it apply in the context of a passcode? But I would apply still old precedent to that question. So for example, for something, for a statement by a defendant to trigger Fifth Amendment protection, it must be three things. We've talked a lot about compulsion. This is compelled. No question about it. Under this order, it's being compelled. I'm not going to argue any differently. It requires two other things. The statement itself must be incriminating, and it must be testimonial. Under the facts of this case, I don't know how it's incriminating or testimonial, and I say that respectfully because we are granting use immunity over the passcode itself. How could that code be incriminating or testimonial? And I understand what counsel's saying about the contents of one's mind and speaking something. We've talked about it in the context of voice exemplars, handwriting exemplars, but this court has long allowed us to ask certain questions, limited questions, that call for a defendant to use his or her mind to answer. For example.
So I have booking questions?
Booking questions. It's never been a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Pedigree information. Date of birth, where do you live, what's your name, never been a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Ministerial questions, very similar, never been a violation of the Fifth Amendment. All of those things have been permitted by this court.
So you're saying that the brain is being used to answer those questions, but the decisions carefully shape those questions so they don't end up being incriminating. This is really a little bit different from that.
And I am, that's exactly what I'm asking for here. I'm asking the court to conduct or carve out a careful section here.
They carved out the booking because the court concluded that these are not incriminating statements, saying your name. We know that the reason why you want the code is because it will be incriminating.
The code?
Or it will lead to incriminating information, unlike booking questions.
That's correct. The code itself, though, I most likely, and I don't know what the code is in this case, nobody here does, but
we'd be very upset to hear that you do know the code at 4 o'clock.
I understand. So I suspect it's probably a jumble of letters or numbers. That's usually what it is for most folks. Without any meaning. But to the extent it does have meaning, there's use immunity that attaches here. One other fact
that
would
just say,
like,
if you brought someone before a grand jury, you compelled them to testify, it would not only be use, it would be derivative. Everything that you could have learned from that. You're trying to really hem in
the
immunity here.
Correct. And the testimony itself, yes, you would have to grant use, derivative immunity as well. I don't believe over the code itself, especially when it's backed up against a warrant, I think use immunity itself covers it. One other fact I just asked the court to consider, I know we're late, but the defendant's status as a police officer, because it has not been raised at all, and I think it matters. I really think it matters, and the reason I think it matters, the defendant was texting a co-defendant while, as he was a police officer, while he was on duty, he was texting, calling a co-defendant about sources, methods, outing undercover informants, outing undercover vehicles. He was doing that from his place of employment in the Sheriff's Department. As a prosecutor, I instruct every police officer in our county that if you use even your own personal cell phone to text or call about an investigation to another police officer, let alone a co-defendant, that you are losing to some degree your expectation of privacy over that cell phone.
So but that's a Fourth Amendment issue.
It's a Fourth Amendment issue,
and
but
I think your Fourth Amendment issues are covered by your warrant, or their warrant.
They are. I just think it makes a difference if we're talking about balancing here, or balancing of interests, because
maybe
the question that I have is not Lowry entitled as a matter of due process to the information on Andrew's phone? He's a co-defendant. Those text messages, those phone calls relate directly to him. How about the other dozens of defendants that got tried in this case, that had charges leveled against them in this case? This was a big operation. Do they not have discovery rights to the information on his phone? I think they do. At least I think it's an issue. So I think when this defendant, at work, texting about an ongoing investigation to a co-defendant, there's an aspect of privacy that he has given up.
But you know that information based on the co-defendant.
Based on the co-defendant.
And he told you what he had texted.
Yes.
And what had been on his phone.
Correct.
And the fact that the defendant told him to wipe out everything that was on.
Destroy everything. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sierra, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
Very, very brief. To the degree that my client's position as a police officer will have any implication at all, it will be only if we were to prevail at the criminal case and then try to preserve his job under the administrative code. He is treated no differently than anyone else before the court on matters of the Fifth Amendment. There's been a lot of back and forth about what attempts were made to get into the phone, what continued. This entire matter comes before you without having a hearing, not only on the issues of attempts to get into the phone, but also on the issues of what proofs that they have with regard to this foregone conclusion. So what you're looking at now is basically argument from the investigative file. And nothing more with regard to what we can substantiate here as we stand here as attorneys, just telling you that we can't get in there still to this date. The idea that child pornographers are going to run free, everybody's going to run free because of this technology, my client is still going to be on trial. I made a motion to dismiss. It was denied. I was months, if not weeks, from a trial date, and then this motion was filed. He will face all of the charges that are pending against him. And if the proofs are as strong as counsel has indicated that they are with regard to the tie-in to the conduct on the phone, then they should have no problem being able to demonstrate what it is that they want to prove to a court or to a jury.
Counsel, I don't believe that you can persuasively argue by keeping evidence from the prosecution, it doesn't matter to them. I think your argument is you either have that right or you don't.
That's right. And I'll finish this way. There was question about exhaustion of remedies, if we're out of, the balancing test. I said this, I'll just leave it at this. I was talking to my school-age children the other day about this case, going down to argue for the first time before the Supreme Court. And I explained to them what it was, and I said, as a kid growing up, the TV shows, the cultural was, you have the right to remain silent, anything you say will be used against you. And I said to them, that was based in case law, and now, what's before the court now is, you have the right to remain silent sometimes. You have the right to remain silent usually. That is not what 230 years ago they put into the Bill of Rights. And Your Honors, it is as firm a position as it existed then and it does now, that he cannot be compelled in violation of the Fifth Amendment to give that information. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the very helpful argument. take the matter under advisement, court's in recess.